May it please the Court, I am Brett Fallon of Morris James LLP, representing appellant Michael B. Targoff in this matter. With me today is Christopher Lozides, representing appellant Loral Space and Communications, Inc. I'm pleased to introduce to the Court J.P. Lefkowitz, a partner at Kirkland & Ellis. We have moved his admission pro hac vice in this matter, and he will be presenting argument for appellants.
Thank you. Welcome to the Court.
Thank you.
Are we ready? Please proceed.
May it please the Court. My name is Jay Lefkowitz, and I represent the appellants. This case presents an important issue that lies at the intersection of two of this Court's important recent precedents, Tooley v. Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette in 2004, and Gentile v. Rossetti in 2006. The specific question that I'd like to address this afternoon in a few short moments is whether, in light of Tooley and Gentile, a shareholder may bring a direct action in a case involving a claim of overpayment of stock to a controlling shareholder when the corporation still exists and is participating in a derivative suit that will fully vindicate the harms alleged. I'd like to start with the key holding in Tooley and then briefly discuss Gentile.
Well, before we get to that lofty level, can you tell me in what form this issue came up in the Court of Chancery?
Yes, Your Honor. We opposed the motion to certify a class.
Okay, so the first issue then is, did the Court err in certifying the class?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that the Court erred in certifying the class. As we articulated below, we believe that there was no standing to maintain the action in which the plaintiff sought class certification. And we articulated many of the same arguments that we're raising here on appeal.
But there's no direct appeal of that ruling, is there?
Well, this was the first opportunity. We have now a final judgment, and this is the first opportunity to raise that issue on appeal. I would note, Your Honor, that standing is jurisdictional, and this Court's precedents hold that it can be raised at any time, indeed even sua sponte, by the Court. But this is the first opportunity we have to raise the appeal in this context. Now, Tooley makes clear, and it was a landmark decision, that whether a stockholder's claim is derivative or direct turns solely on two questions: who suffered the alleged harm, the corporation or the shareholder, and to whom would any remedy flow? Again, either the corporation or the shareholder. Now, to be sure, this Court has recognized certain circumstances where the corporation and the shareholder may each be harmed, and where the same set of facts can give rise to both.
I'm sorry, I have to interrupt you because I'm still mulling over your last comment about standing.
Sure.
Was it presented to the Vice Chancellor below that there was no standing for an award of attorney's fees?
Well, we are appealing the class certification. Had the Court granted our opposition and denied class certification, then the direct action and the class action would not have been able to proceed in its entirety.
Okay, well, you're challenging not only the class certification but also the fee award.
Correct, Your Honor, and as I will explain in what I hope will be the bulk of my argument here, there should be no fee award whatsoever because there was no standing in the first instance. If the Court disagrees with me, we can address the secondary question. Now, the Court has recognized certain circumstances, as I said, that are exceptions to that rule in Tooley.
Excuse me for a moment. Is it correct to say then that the second issue depends entirely on the resolution of the first issue?
Well, I would suggest, Your Honor, that if we are correct that there is no standing here, then there should not be any fee award at all.
Because there's no party that should have gotten a fee.
That is correct.
But what if we disagree with your class certification?
If you disagree and believe that you can somehow reconcile Gentile and Tooley and permit this case to proceed, then I would suggest, Your Honor, that the fee award was still inappropriate. That would be addressed on an abuse of discretion standard, not de novo.
In other words, it was too high, even if some fee was awardable.
That's correct. It was too high, and I will address that as well, Your Honor. But what I'd like to focus on initially is what the court's ruling in Gentile was. Because in Gentile, the court said that when a controlling shareholder causes the issuance of excessive shares to himself and minority shareholders suffer a corresponding decrease in voting power, a direct action may lie over the redistribution of the voting power, even though the corporation has suffered a harm, which is traditionally a classic derivative case. So Gentile clearly created an exception to Tooley, and I think it was an appropriate exception because in that case there was no alternative for the shareholders who were injured to get a remedy because a derivative lawsuit could not be brought. And indeed,
let me interrupt you there. Aren't you adding an extra factor? In other words, aren't you saying that the exception, if you will, was based upon the need to provide an avenue for relief, and since there's no need to provide that avenue of relief because there's a derivative claim that's available, the exception no longer applies?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. What this court said in Gentile, and I'm quoting here from page 103 of that decision, is that in this specific case, meaning Gentile, the sole relief that is presently available is a direct action. Because Single Point, the company in that case, no longer exists, there are no overpayment shares that a court of equity could cancel. So there's no corporate entity to which a recovery could be paid. And, Your Honor, the reason I think it's clear that that's the only way to read Gentile is if you look at what the standard is in Tooley for determining whether there is an individual harm, what the court says in Tooley at page 1039 is, a court should look to the nature of the wrong and to whom the relief should go. And then it says, the stockholder's claimed direct injury must be independent of any alleged injury to the corporation, which clearly existed in Gentile, and I would submit exists here under Vice Chancellor's decision. But then it says, and the stockholder must demonstrate that he or she can prevail without showing an injury to the corporation. Now, I would submit, Your Honor, that in a traditional case of overpayment, even involving a controlling shareholder, if you cannot demonstrate a harm to the corporation, then, of course, there's no harm whatsoever.
Well, the Gentile says that in those narrow circumstances, there is both a derivative and a class claim. So both claims could be brought.
Well, but again, if you read the Tooley
Let me finish.
Okay, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Doesn't that dispose of the standing argument? I mean, isn't the real problem, if there is a problem, one of a avoiding a double recovery, that is a duplicative recovery? The damages are the same on the direct shareholder's claim and the derivative claim, then only one or the other can recover the damages. Well, they can't both. Both sets of plaintiffs can't recover. But that is a different question from standing, isn't it?
Your Honor, I actually think they're really the same question, and they're going to the same point. If, as a general rule, an overpayment case, which is, after all, adjudicated on the basis of the entire fairness of the transaction, and the court determines, as Vice Chancellor Strine determined, that this transaction was unfair, what did he have to do? He had to change it to make it fair to the corporation. And that is a classic derivative situation. The exception that Gentile recognized was an exception that said even though Tooley says that the stockholder has to show that he can prevail without showing a harm to the corporation, we, in effect, are going to overlook that or override that. That's the exception. Otherwise,
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I get the drift. If the teaching of Rossetti was that there are two kinds of claims that can be generated by that peculiar factual paradigm, doesn't that dispose of the standing argument? And if it doesn't, then for us to accept your position, what would be the rule of law that we would have to adopt?
Well, I think the rule of law that you would have to adopt, Your Honor, is a rule of law that says when a claim of overpayment to a controlling shareholder is raised or is at issue in a transaction, if a derivative action can be brought which will fully vindicate all of the harm to all of the shareholders, then that must be brought. In other words, Tooley set forth a program to avoid having to deal with this special injury that this court had grappled with for many years. And it said, you look solely to these two questions.
So you're adding, a gloss, or asking us to gloss to some extent Rossetti by holding that, yes, although, you know, that fact paradigm can give rise to both derivative and direct claims, the derivative claim trumps the direct claim as long as a derivative remedy can be granted.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that's the only way to read Gentile without finding that it overruled Tooley. Because remember, there are two parts to the Tooley test. The first is who was injured, and I understand the court has found that in this type of controller situation, both the corporation and the individual can be harmed. Then the question is who gets the remedy? Well, in the controller situation with an overpayment claim, the corporation gets the remedy. The shareholders, to the extent that they benefit, benefit entirely indirectly and derivatively. In fact, members of the class who were injured by the transaction in this case may not have even been shareholders as of the time the judgment was implemented and therefore wouldn't benefit at all.
Well, didn't the Vice Chancellor here also eliminate the control rights?
That's true. And again, that was intended, as Vice Chancellor Strine said, to remedy the harm to the corporation. The corporation, he had found, had effectively given a deal to its controlling shareholder that was too sweet. It was giving him so much voting share that it was effectively giving him control without extracting a control premium. So how did the court remedy that harm? It found it was not entirely fair to the corporation, and it did a few things, including eliminating those extra voting rights. But again, those only derivatively or indirectly benefited the shareholders, and indeed, it benefited some of the shareholders who had nothing to do with owning the company when the transaction took place, but may have bought the stock when they saw how the trial was developing, so that they were shareholders of record as of the time the judgment was entered.
I must have misunderstood you. You're saying that a recovery that changes the voting rights of the stockholders is only an indirect benefit to the stockholders?
It is a direct benefit to the company because it
I'm talking about the stockholders.
Yes.
If the stockholders go from having the public stockholders go from having a total of 40% of the vote to having a total of 60% of the vote, you're telling me that's only an indirect benefit?
In the same way, Your Honor, that in any corporate overpayment case, including the corporate overpayment cases that are to third parties, obviously every shareholder always benefits from a derivative recovery. Because if the company is made whole, then obviously the shareholders are protected. If I was a purchaser, if I was an owner of Goldman Sachs stock, I might have an argument that they have diluted me unfairly because they gave preferred stock to Warren Buffett. But if it was a fair transaction, then my dilution is not harmful. If it was an unfair dilution, then if they force the company to remedy the deal so that Buffett only pays the appropriate amount, then I still may be diluted, but it's not unfair. So whatever benefit I get at that point is only derivative. The remedy in this situation goes to the company. Now, I understand.
I think that you've stated clearly your argument that, you know, where you can bring both a derivative and a direct claim, the derivative claim trumps if it's possible to affect a derivative recovery. My question to you is a very narrow one, and that is, where does that rule come from? Does it come from Gentile versus Rossetti, or is it a rule that you're asking us to adopt for other, you know, that is, in other words, a rule that's not yet recognized, but that you are asking us to recognize for the reasons you're arguing?
It's a rule, Your Honor. It's a fair question. It's a rule that I am extracting from what I believe is the only way to reconcile Gentile with Tooley. Gentile makes clear in its language that it fit within the framework of Tooley. Tooley asked two questions. And if you were to simply ignore the fact that Gentile was dealing with a controlling shareholder and needed to come up with a special rule, the Gentile facts would not have allowed a direct action under the Tooley test, because the shareholder could not demonstrate a harm to himself without also showing a harm to the corporation, test one. And test two, the remedy would flow to the corporation. But Gentile created an exception. And what I am submitting, Your Honors, is that the exception is simply an acceptable exception that leaves Tooley intact if you recognize that the dispositive fact in Gentile was that there was no alternative vehicle for recovery. And Gentile makes that point very clearly on the last page. After it says that it fits comfortably within the framework mandated by Tooley, it says, finally, in this specific case, the sole relief available is the direct action. And what I'm suggesting is that if you read Gentile more broadly, then what you've done is you've basically overruled Tooley, because the two-part test in Tooley is no longer a valid test for deciding whether a case involving a controlling shareholder is derivative or direct.
You're into your rebuttal time. You're welcome to use it or reserve it.
Your Honor, thank you very much. I'll reserve and respond. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Travis Laster for Appellee. There's a simple reason why Vice Chancellor Strawn granted attorney's fees in this case, and it's dispositive of both the standing issue and the abuse of discretion issue on the amount. And that's because we were a key part, my firm was a key part of a litigation effort that was the sole cause of hugely substantial benefits. Let me focus on that phrase, hugely substantial, because it sounds like advocacy. Those were Vice Chancellor Strine's own words at page A588 of the record. It's clearly a hugely substantial benefit to Loral and its public stockholders. Not just a benefit to Loral, also a benefit to its public stockholders. On the abuse of discretion issue, those benefits were quantifiable. My friends, and this is a theme you'll hear repeatedly from me this afternoon, my friends say the exact opposite. On page 16 of their reply brief, they say, this case did not produce any quantifiable benefit. On page 16, they say, the Court of Chancery concluded that the benefit was not quantifiable. Here's what Vice Chancellor Strine said. This is clearly a quantifiable benefit. That's at page 573 of the record. It's clearly a financial benefit to Loral. That's at A579 of the record. We were there. We did the work. We did a lot of the work. And under Tandycraft's, this is dispositive of the standing issue and the fee issue. We spent 6,000 hours on this case. We took 11 of the depositions. Paul Weiss took 16. We took 11. That's a lot. I personally argued 6 of the 8 contested motions. Paul Weiss did 2. I did 6. We had 2 of the experts. Paul Weiss had 1. I handled 2. We had a major role in every aspect of the case, including 5 of the 12 trial witnesses. And Vice Chancellor Strine saw this. He had a firsthand perspective on the entire case that, respectfully, this court, as a court of appeals, can never have. Under Tandycraft's, that is dispositive. In Tandycraft's, this court said there is no class action or derivative suit prerequisite to an award of attorney's fees. The issue in Tandycraft was whether a stockholder who just showed up and brought a case individually could seek a fee award. So even if they were right, and we're there under no other auspices than representing Highland, under Tandycraft's, we get a fee. And in answer to Your Honor's questions about appealing the class certification ruling, they didn't appeal from the merits ruling in this case. They solely appealed from the fee award. I would submit to Your Honors that the class certification issue is part of the merits ruling. No one ever appealed from the merits ruling. We're solely here on fees, and this is a collateral attack on fees. Now, on Gentile. Make no mistake, Vice Chancellor Strawn correctly applied Gentile. And the court doesn't have to reach Gentile because Tandy Crafts is dispositive. They've never disputed. They've never distinguished Tandy Crafts in a case. In one footnote, footnote 13, they say, oh, but Abrams-Laster shouldn't have been in the case. You know what? You don't get to say who the other side's attorneys are. I didn't get to dispute the fact that there were eight law firms on the other side, and they don't get to dispute who the plaintiffs get to represent them. So they've never disputed Tandy Crafts. But this is a classic Gentile situation. What Gentile said, Justice Jacobs, writing for the court, said, this is an expropriation situation. It's not an underpayment situation. And that's what happened here. $300 million came into Loral. $300 million came into the corporation. That's a great benefit for the corporation. The corporation has benefited. What did the corporation lose? Paper. And what did that paper do? It moved the needle at the stockholder level. It moved the needle from MHR having 35.9 all the way up to having 63% of the equity, plus lots of voting rights on a class basis, voting rights on an individual share basis. All that happened at the stockholder level, not at the corporate level. So sure, somebody could come in and claim that perhaps they should have gotten more money at the corporate level. Perhaps they should have gotten 400. Perhaps they should have gotten $500 million. But what Loral got was $300 million in return for paper. And where was that impact? That impact was only at the ownership. And that's why, in the words of Justice Jacobs, Gentile deals with a situation that is not underpayment. It's expropriation. It's expropriation of value and voting rights from the non-controllers to the controllers. And that's why, in that situation, you have two injuries, one to the corporation, one to the stockholders, two potential remedies, one direct, one derivative.
Assuming Hyland was not involved in this case, so would the remedy have been the same?
I don't think we can say that, Your Honor. Now, we did not have one of the things they told us they were going to do is not challenge our hours. Of course, they're indirectly challenging ours by saying we didn't do anything. But we did not, therefore, have some forensic evaluation of who did what in the case, who argued what. But the derivative and the class plaintiffs do not necessarily have the same interest in remedy. If a derivative plaintiff is solely representing the corporation and focused solely on what the corporation gets, what they care about is more money for the corporation. So this case could have been tried solely as an underpayment case. There's a reason why Paul Weiss's expert looked solely at the value of Loral. There's a reason why our experts looked at the voting rights and the dilution at the stockholder level. Had this been tried solely from the derivative plaintiff's perspective, Your Honor, I respectfully submit the award might have just been more money. And there would have been no necessary remedy at the stockholder level. That's why we submit that we did it right in this case. We think that normally in a case, all the plaintiffs line up, you know, the four or five, however many firms, they all work together, they push the same claims. What we did is when we sat down, when we knew we were both going to be here, we and Paul Weiss were both going to be here, we said, look, we've sued on a class basis, you've sued on a derivative basis. Rather than realigning and everybody taking everything, let's keep it that way. And if we disagree about the remedy, if there's ever a conflict, if you guys, for example, want to argue, oh, it should just be money, or we want to argue at the stockholder level, oh, it shouldn't be money, it should just be reallocation, well, great. We each have our client. We can each make those pitches to the court. But what in fact happened is we worked together, and that's what you want. And Vice Chancellor Strawn oversaw that. He wanted to be sure that there wasn't unnecessary duplication of effort. He wanted to make sure that there wasn't a duplicative recovery. And so we worked together, and we hashed it out between ourselves what the remedy ought to be. So, Justice Ridgely, I can't tell you, Your Honor, because we can't turn back the clock. I can't tell you that there wouldn't have been a similar remedy. Vice Chancellor Strawn himself actually suggested the remedy here, so maybe they would have done it. But I do know that from purely the derivative standpoint, you're looking at money, whereas from the class's standpoint, you're looking at voting rights and allocation. And I do know that Paul Weiss's expert was focused on value of the entity, whereas our experts were focused on dilution and voting rights. So I think it was critical to the remedy that we were there. I want to focus on Gentile and this idea that Gentile should only apply when the underlying corporation no longer exists. That's wrong. And it's wrong in light of post-Gentile precedent from this court and from the Court of Chancery. First case, Gatz v. Ponselt. Justice Jacobs, the author of Gentile, writing for this court en banc. What happened there? Ponselt went from a non-controlling position at around 38% to a controlling position at around 60%. And in the same transaction, he was able to monetize his control by selling at the stockholder level. The entity continued. The minority stockholders continued. If my friends were right, GATS should have held no direct claim, only a derivative claim. Justice Jacobs, writing for this court in Bonk, holds both exist. Their rule can't be right in light of GATS. Two Court of Chancery decisions reaching the same conclusion. Baker versus Sidney Frank Importing, asset sale. Minority stockholders continue. Chancellor Chandler, direct claim. Rhodes v. Silk Road Equity, Chancellor Noble. Two controllers alleged to have diluted the entity through convertible notes. Motion to dismiss. Vice Chancellor Noble holds direct claim. Can't be right. They can't be right. Now let's look at the flip side. If they're right, then in a case where the entity didn't continue, this court should have held direct claim. What happened in Feldman v. Kutaya? Justice Holland, writing for a panel including Justice Berger and Justice Steele, plaintiffs claimed dilution from options. Entity was merged out of existence. If their rule is right, that should have been a direct claim. Held no. Not a direct claim under Gentile because there wasn't a controlling stockholder. So they're not right when the entity continues, and they're not right when the entity disappears. Now, it is true that there is language in Gentile that my counterpart read, which says, and by the way, in this case, it's particularly fair because the entity is no longer there. But that was an additional reason in Gentile. It's not part of the core analysis. It's a factual observation. Gentile is no more limited to cases where the corporation is no longer in existence as it is to cases involving debt being converted to equity. Those were two factual situations affiliated with Gentile, but neither one drives the analysis.
Well, I may have misunderstood.
Yes, sir.
The other side's argument. I didn't quite understand the argument to be that where the facts give rise to both derivative and direct claims, then the derivative claim trumps if the corporation, unless the corporation is no longer in existence. I thought the argument was that the derivative claim would trump if a derivative recovery is possible in the circumstances. And if that's right, then I suppose your response would be, well, it may be possible, but it wouldn't be sufficient.
It's not sufficient, Your Honor. And I actually, respectfully from your briefing, I think they started out saying either or. They started out saying Gentile says either direct or derivative. And then we quoted Your Honor's opinion, which says also. It says and, not or. And so then they came back on their reply brief and said, oh, we meant when the corporation no longer exists. But to Your Honor's question, I think that's exactly right. The court, the vice chancellor, would have to look as to whether the derivative recovery was sufficient. And if the derivative recovery didn't address the expropriation, didn't address that separate stockholder injury, then it would not be sufficient, and both claims would and should go forward.
So it's just as a matter of case management, in these limited circumstances where you have a Rossetti fact pattern, your point would be that it is possible and presumably desirable to have both a direct and a derivative action going on at the same time because you might have different remedies that would flow from each.
I think it is, Your Honor. And I'm not saying that one person can't initially bring both, but the court then has to be mindful of the fact, and there's a line in the Southern District, there's a line of authority out of the Southern District of New York that actually finds this an inherent conflict between direct claims and derivative claims, and they've disqualified people from doing both because you can't be suing the corporation at the same time you're representing the corporation. We have not followed that in Delaware. We've said, look, people can bring both these. But I think counsel in the court in that situation has to be mindful of the potential for conflict. Far better, we and Paul Weiss thought, to have people aligned so that they're each looking out for the person they ought to be looking out for. So I think far from being this being a case where we did it wrong, as my friends say, this is a case where we actually did it precisely right. And this is the key thing, because without their legal angle, and their legal angle I think is destroyed by GATS, by Kutaya, by Sidney v. Bakerman, without that they have to say, oh, well, there's duplicative litigation. There's not duplicative litigation. The Court of Chancery, as this court said in Tandy Crafts, the Court of Chancery can watch out for that. If the Court of Chancery is there, they know what's going on, they know what people are doing. He could have knocked us in our fee for that, and he specifically did say he knocked us in our fee in part because we weren't the sole people driving the bus. That's the way it ought to happen. This court doesn't have to rewrite the Gentile framework for this case. Now, I'd like to talk briefly about the exercise of discretion issue and whether the Vice Chancellor properly exercises discretion. Now, my friends have posited some facts, on which this Court should supposedly exercise its discretion to overrule the Vice Chancellor's discretion. And unfortunately, I have to correct an awful lot of them. And that's starting with pages 5 and 6 of their statement of facts in their opening brief. If the Court looks at that, they are citing to their pretrial briefs. They're not citing to the post-trial opinion. They cite to their pretrial briefs to say Loral needed $300 million, to say Loral needed it all in the form of equity, and to say that Loral turned to MHR. Loral was the instigator. Well, at that point, we had a post-trial opinion. And if you look through Vice Chancellor Strine's over 90-page opinion, you will see that he repeatedly rejects each one of those statements. But you don't have to look any further than the first page of that opinion to see that the Vice Chancellor held that there was no magic to the $300 million. That's his line on page 1, that it did not have to be in all equity, and that the source of the idea wasn't Loral, it was MHR. He even says, conceived by MHR's creator, Mark Rachefsky. So the truth, as the Vice Chancellor found at trial, and that decision was final at the time they filed the brief, the exact opposite of what they say this Court ought to use in exercising its discretion. Second key point, they attack my firm and my motives. They say, as we now know, the real reason that A&L filed its claim was in the hope of reaping a huge payday for itself. That's at page 2 of the reply brief. That's wrong. We were here, and we were in this case because we received a call from Highland. Highland asked us to take this case on a contingent basis. We were amenable to that. We did talk about a fixed fee basis. They didn't want to do it. They were going to have somebody litigate this case on contingency, and we were fine with that. Now, here's where that's in the record, A572. This is what they base all these attacks on our motives on. Vice Chancellor Strine asked me at the fee hearing, he said, Mr. Laster, did you ever talk about with Highland about taking this on an hourly basis? Here's what I said. We talked about it. It was a joint decision. They didn't want to pay our base rates. We wanted the opportunity to take it on contingency. So it was a combination of the two. And that's exactly what happened. And that's the sole basis for this theme on appeal, that we were in this for just some mercenary, free-riding reason.
I'd like to ask you to comment on the multiplier and the premium. The other side has cited I think Chancellor Chandler is saying 400% is too high.
Sure.
What is too high?
I'll address that directly. And let me first address that by talking about Seinfeld and the 400%. It's not 400%. It's 300%. We got base rates and a 4x multiplier on base rates. That's base plates plus 3. That's 300%. Now, this is consistent with candor. In their opening brief, they said 7 times, 400%, 400%, 400%, 400%. We came back and said, your math is wrong. 2 times 2 is not 5. I would have thought that they would have said, you're right, we got the math wrong, but it's still too high. Instead, twice in their reply brief, they said 400%, 400%. Now, is 400% too high? Seinfeld was a case I actually represented the defendants. Okay? It was a goodbye payment to directors. The case settled right after we answered. There wasn't even briefing on a motion to dismiss. Now, in that context where nobody did anything, where there were no heroic efforts by anyone, that is a case where the Chancellor did say, you know, 400% is too much. Interestingly, though, the plaintiffs in that case got approximately, I have to try to find in my notes, they got $1,300 an hour as their effective rate in that case. We got $1,300 an hour, $1,322, as our effective rate in this case, a case that was contentious, that went on for a year, where we took it through trial to a post-trial decision. I think that the decision as to what multiplier to apply is inherently in the discretion of the Court of Chancery. Vice Chancellor Strine is someone who has cut people on fees and cut them repeatedly. Here's some hourly numbers. Franklin Balance Sheet Fund, pre-trial settlement, they got $4,000 an hour effective rate. TCI, pre-trial settlement, $3,800 effective rate. Lynn Brand, pre-trial settlement, $3,800. Again, pretrial settlement. NCS Healthcare, pretrial settlement, $3,000 an hour. AXA Financial, $2,600 an hour. This is a table that's in the record at B1556. The Chancellor has a sense for what is appropriate. That's what his discretion is for. In this case, the $205 million in quantifiable benefits, had everyone been contingent, that could have easily supported a fee award of $60, $70 million. And the Vice Chancellor said specifically, if everyone was contingent here, I wouldn't have a problem with that. I could see that happening. But he dropped us, and he dropped us significantly because he recognized that we were part of the load. We argued that we should get half, that Paul Weiss should get half, that we should get half. He obviously thought differently. What we ended up with, if one thinks in terms of generally a third of the benefit as appropriate, an appropriate award in a type of case like this, half of that for us would have been 17%. A third of that, three law firms, 10%. His award to us was about 5%. So I think by any measure, Your Honor, what we received was reasonable. And the multiplier of four, as Vice Chancellor Strein said, to his mind, it was actually a relatively low multiplier. I want to address two other things quickly. This idea that we made an egregious misstatement to the court, they put egregious misstatement in bold. What we said in our brief was that Loral contends that this fee is covered by insurance. They came back and said that's an egregious misstatement. I'd like to hear from Mr. Lefkowitz, because he's actually litigating in New York right now in the view that Loral contends that this is covered by insurance. I'd like to know if that's his position, because he told this court that was an egregious misstatement by me. Same way in terms of who was paying the fees for my opponents when they were briefing down below. That's in the record at A568. Loral, in fact, was paying their fees. It wasn't a baseless statement by us. On the discretion element, I'd like to close with what Vice Chancellor said specifically, Vice Chancellor Strein. Two sentences. I took into account the factor that there were derivative plaintiffs, and that resulted in a substantial reduction in the amount of fee requested to Mr. Laster. My sense is if my ruling were wrong, it was probably wrong in being conservative. That's in the record at B1723. I appreciate the court's time.
Thank you.
Your Honors, with respect to both sides of this argument here, again, I would ask the court to go back and look at the second question in Thule. To whom does the remedy go? Here, and in all of these types of cases, the remedy has to go to the corporation if the corporation exists. Because if the transaction is reformed so that it is a fair transaction, then by definition, it's a fair transaction. There is no remaining harm. Now, in Gentil, there was no corporation. And if you allow a direct action here, when the remedy should go to the corporation, then there is really nothing left of either prong of Thule. And as Justice Berger said, yes, you don't really need a direct action here. And if you allow a direct action, then I think, Justice Jacobs, it does create a serious problem of double recovery. Because the derivative award, by definition, if it's a complete award, satisfies and is sufficient. Now, Your Honor.
Are you going to address Tandy Crafts?
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest, I will. I'd just like to make the point. There was no question that this is an expropriation case, but it's an expropriation case that falls within the confines of the way this court articulated its ruling in Gentil. And Gentil cannot be read, I would submit, more broadly than the facts when you don't have a corporation remaining to address a derivative case. Because if you have a derivative case available, you create a problem of double recovery. That's what Thule was intending to avoid. Now, with respect to the remaining issues that my friend here raised, I found it very instructive that he was relying on common fund cases to justify his fee award. Because, again, Judge Vice Chancellor Strein made clear that there was no actual fund here that was created. There was no monetary benefit. There was clearly a benefit to the corporation. That was the purpose of the derivative lawsuit. So I would suggest, Your Honor, that if this court is going to permit direct actions when there are derivative actions not only available but even pending, then at the very least we don't want to incentivize direct actions by having significant attorney fee awards. Were Mr. Laster's firm to have been given an hourly basis, they would have, in effect, been partnering with the rest of the derivative shareholder plaintiffs. But what happens here with this lodestar approach and the three times multiplier is there's an incentive to bring these types of lawsuits. And there's a double recovery problem, Your Honor.
Are you making an argument as a matter of law or a discretionary argument?
I'm making a discretionary argument, Your Honor.
You're saying as a matter of discretion, the court of chancery cannot award anything other than hours times a reasonable hourly rate in these circumstances?
I'm suggesting, Your Honor, no. I'm suggesting that clearly the case and the determination of the fee has to fall within the discretion. I'm saying that the discretion should be cabined or should focus and take into account what is trying to be incentivized here. If you look at the original complaint that the direct action plaintiffs filed, their prayer for relief would not have helped the company at all. They were asking for a rights offering. They were, in effect,
saying, cut all shareholders in. Your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court will take this matter under advisement and take a brief recess.